Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, May 9th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. All right, guys, I'm really excited this week because we have a new sponsor on the show. This week's episode of Talk Nerdy is brought to you by OVAudioVideo.com, your one-stop shop for all your audio, video, and surveillance needs. Whether you're a drone hobbyist, a broadcaster, or anything in between, visit OVAudioVideo.com today. And don't forget to use the coupon code TALKNERDY for 10% off your entire order. Once again, that's OVAudioVideo.com. This week's episode is also brought to you by you. You guys have been so amazing in supporting the show week after week and sticking with me. And this week, I want to give a specific shout out to the top supporters of Talk Nerdy. You can do so as well if you visit patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge your support. Remember, once again, Talk Nerdy is 100% free to download, and it's because of support from listeners like you that we can continue to make the show week after week. So this week, I want to thank Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Charles Payet, Jafe, The Honorable Husband, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and last but absolutely not least, Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so very much. Guys, I'm also really excited because this week I chat with a friend and brilliant creator named Vanessa Hill. You may know her as the host and brains behind Braincraft on YouTube, a PBS Digital Studios series. So without any further ado, let's dive right in. Here she is, Vanessa Hill. Vanessa, thank you so much for taking the time to have a delicious brunch with me and then joining me in my ever-evolving podcast studio.
My pleasure.
I'm so excited. So Vanessa and I just set up the second brand new mic. I am on the first brand. They're the exact same. So new mics.
Yeah.
Thanks to you guys, the listeners, I was able to upgrade. It might still be a little echoey. I'm trying to work on that. We put up curtains.
That's nice. It's very helping. Plush.
It's very plush.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of blank white reverbery walls.
Yeah.
So a lot of corners, which apparently is not good for audio. So eventually we'll get there, but it's, you know, piece by piece.
There is sound dampening. It's just in a pile.
It's in a pile in the corner. Yeah.
It could help. Who knows?
It's just not quite hung yet.
Yeah.
So you have to do a lot of audio work in your videos too, because sometimes you do videos that are your face, your body, you're talking, you're either in front of a green screen or like a white psych, you know, it's just you, direct to camera, which obviously you have to have good audio for.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's animated, so it's just your voice.
Yeah. So I guess actually it's funny that you bring up audio because I hardly ever think of audio because I have a video series. It's like an afterthought. It's like I need to make sure that this isn't so echoey and that like the mic placement is good. But other than that, it's just like, okay, like the microphone's on, the levels are fine. Like let's worry about like how I'm looking and speaking and like what my hands are doing when I'm talking and everything like that. So
it's a lot to think about.
It's so much to think about. And I think more often than not, I get one aspect wrong. As in, like, my mic placement is crappy or the focus is soft or I don't know what it is. Like, my hair is all over the place. And then it just ends up looking like I've just gotten out of bed. And then people are commenting, like, did you brush your hair this week? And I'm like, well, no, but thanks for noticing.
And it's hard when you're doing it by yourself, right? When you don't have somebody. Like when I do TV shoots where there's like a full team, it's so crazy how they overly obsess and dote on you. And in between every take, they bring out the hairspray. And then you think, wow, when I do this by myself, I must look like dog shit because like there's no one here to primp.
Yeah. I mean, I have people occasionally who will help me film, except the problem is that they're a shooter. Like they're not a producer. They're not looking at you or how you look or like what your hair is doing or anything like that. I feel like it's weird that we're just talking about hair now.
No, but it's funny because it's the shit that you don't care about,
yes,
you don't think about,
yeah,
and then everybody obsesses over,
yeah,
it.
And then so they'll just be shooting, and then like I'll go to start editing the raw footage, and I'll be like, oh my god, you can see my bra the entire time, for example, and I'll, yeah, be like, why didn't they say anything? Except it's not their job. Like, they don't care. They don't even notice.
They don't notice. And that's, yeah, something I find when I'm doing more of the journalistic stuff than the hosty stuff, because,
yeah,
I'm often out in the field with just a shooter and a sound guy, and they're almost always men.
Mm.
And so whenever there's a woman on set, whether it's a PA or I happen to be lucky enough to have a female shooter, or there is a producer, I find that the conscientiousness about like, oh, you've got a little bit of mascara under your eye, or,
yeah,
oh, honey, like you've got like your shirt's tucked in weird, let me fix that. Just, I find that when I work with men, they just don't even notice. And then,
yeah,
you're like, I had a boogie in my nose. Shoot, how did you not see that? It's horrible.
Yeah, but then I think, what do people notice when they're your viewers? Because,
yeah,
if the shooter is just like looking at your eyes or whatever naturally catches your attention, then a lot of people will do the same thing. But I think on the internet, all it takes is for like one person to notice something and for them to comment on it. And then like 100 people will like their comment, and it'll,
yeah,
be like, god damn it.
It's the worst. I feel,
yeah,
like I'm very lucky, because when I think about my platforms, generally speaking, where do I put most of my effort? Where do I make most of my money? It's television first, podcasting second, and then web. Well, that might not be true. It might be television first, web second, and then podcasting third. Sometimes those might switch. You know, it's like Pluto's orbit. Like sometimes it's closer, sometimes it's farther. But I definitely find that because I don't have a specific YouTube channel, because I'm not working to cultivate a YouTube audience in that way, I am less privy, if that's the right word to pick, to the horribleness that is internet troll vitriol, all that. Like, people can say horrible things to me on Twitter and Facebook and in the iTunes comments if they want to, but it's just less of a platform for that kind of trolling. You, and I feel like we've got to get into what you do first, because I will have introduced you. This is all, I always feel like I'm time traveling when I podcast.
That's
I will have introduced you at the top of the show when this actually gets published. But just give everybody a little bit of background about Braincraft, first of all, and like what the intentions of the show are and kind of how it works.
Yeah, sure. So Braincraft is a web series that's about psychology and neuroscience and basically why you act the way that you do. So anything like brain and behavior related. I started it on YouTube about 2 years ago, just over 2 years ago. And I think like the intentions of it are mixed, because I really love science and I just wanted to communicate how amazing and human science is and how there's so many things to do with our bodies and our brains and our movement every day that you don't even think about that are really cool. And I wanted to communicate that to people. And then from that intention, it kind of like grows into its own weird thing. So you were talking about the animations. Like, I originally started doing animated pieces because I was intrigued by stop motion as an animation style. That doesn't mean that I was good at it or had any experience with it. I just had like a desk that I was just playing with, and I had a camera and I had a tripod and I got some software, and I was just like playing around with animations and cutting things out of paper and doing like a paper craft kind of style. Because what I wanted was to bring science topics and concepts to people in a really accessible way. And even though it's like weirdly painstaking, anyone can do stop motion if you have a camera or if you have an app on your phone and you have objects around the house, like you can animate still things and bring them to life and try and explain science through them. And that was the original idea that I had, that I wanted to dive into the brain using everyday objects and making them move.
I love that. And your show is kind of a cool hybrid, because it's your show, but it's also through PBS Digital Studios. Is that what they're called?
Yeah, PBS Digital Studios.
And so you share kind of that wonderful brand with Johansson from It's Okay to Be Smart. What are some of the other shows?
There's Gross Science with Anna Rothschild. There's PBS Spacetime with Matt O'Dowd. There's Idea Channel with Mike Ragnetta.
And then the cool thing is you can watch it on YouTube, but you can also like go into your Apple TV and you can go to the PBS app in your Apple TV and you can see everything curated there too, which is really nice.
Yeah, definitely. And I think as a producer or just as a person who does everything on my show, it's nice because you get a lot more respect from people for having the PBS name there as well. With that name comes great responsibility, I suppose, with like researching things and kind of making sure that everything is up to their editorial guidelines, except I quite like it because it's just a great name and educational content.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so like you said, with a name like PBS comes great responsibility, but you also, unfortunately, still have to deal with some of the things that you never would identify with PBS and with the great programming like Frontline. I talk about Frontline all the time because I'm obsessed with Frontline. But, you know, YouTube is still YouTube.
Yeah.
And you still have to deal with the types of just the vitriolic trolling that happens in the comment section of YouTube. How do you deal with that, A, as, you know, I wouldn't say a new YouTuber, but somebody who's been doing it only two plus years now, as a woman, as, I mean, an immigrant, as somebody who, you know, wasn't born here,
came here
to do this kind of work, like, you must be getting it from a lot of sides and people are horrible.
Yeah, I think that I do. And I was actually thinking about this yesterday because I did an episode on some research related to autism, which is always going to be a more emotive topic to certain people just because of the nature of the, see, I called it a disorder in the episode because it's autism spectrum disorder and a lot of people were offended by that. And I was like, it's its scientific name.
Yeah.
Like did I make a mistake? Did I not make a mistake? Like, I don't know what is right or wrong in certain situations. Like talking about having things up to PBS's editorial standards, like I had many people with, I'm just going to call it autism or ASD. I had many people with ASD and parents of kids with ASD read through the script and give feedback and like they were fine with it. But what one group of people are fine with isn't necessarily what others are. And
yeah, because the autism community is not monolithic. And you see it a lot. I've seen people struggle with this when they talk about the deaf community and they talk about, let's say, cochlear implants or things to quote unquote treat deafness or cure deafness get to be very difficult because a lot of people who identify as a strong member of the deaf community are like, I don't need treatment. Like, this is my life. I fluidly speak English. I sign with ASL. It's very good. I don't want, you know, to be a hearing person is not who I am. And I think you're starting to see a change within the autism community of individuals sort of saying, instead of stigmatizing it as a disorder, let's, but also like, I have major depressive disorder.
Yeah.
It's called major depressive disorder.
Yeah.
Like, I definitely want to erase the stigma around depression and I want more people to be able to be open about it, but it is a disorder and that's how you're diagnosed.
Yeah.
So it's hard. It's a hard position to be in.
It is. And I mean, this video that I did was on using stem cells to better understand autism. So it wasn't, I definitely never used the word cure anytime in the piece. And it was just about really cool science and cool techniques that people are doing to try and understand how the brain of a child with autism is different from a brain of a child without autism. And PBS shared the video on their Facebook page, which has millions of likes, which they often do. And sometimes I think that is a blessing and a curse because a post on Facebook doesn't necessarily translate into a lot more YouTube views at all.
Yeah.
All it does is provide a comment space for people to be as horrible as they are on YouTube, really. And it's interesting because for them, they see this as some PBS video that is on YouTube. Whereas for me, it's like my life's work, you know? So it's hard because people are writing like, this video is obnoxious. She's talking to people like we're five, like all this kind of stuff. Like the animation is for children, like all these things. And I'm like, okay, like, I don't know how to reply to this because you talk about TV shows like this. And then I started to think about, what about like a showrunner or a producer that have put their entire life into a program and then it gets really horrible comments as well?
Yeah.
Like, I had never thought about that before until people started talking about my show like that.
The crazy thing is that between Facebook and between YouTube, it's basically the same.
I always
say, as if you are sitting on your couch watching TV, all the little comments that come out of your mouth when you're sitting with your boyfriend or your girlfriends and you're like just stream of consciousness saying what you think. It's yeah. as if there was a two-way radio there and the actors could fucking hear you. Yeah. That's what YouTube is. It's yeah. that people have an outlet to just say whatever the fuck comes to their mind without any screening process mm-hmm. as they're watching the video, because the comment section is asking them to do. And half the time you're soliciting them, right? Part of your job as a YouTuber is to be like, subscribe, comment, yeah, be yeah. active, be engaged. And in the back of your head, you're like, just only say nice things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It is like that. And I mean, people were writing about this video, like, you know, this, you're talking to me like I'm five and this is wrong and blah, 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 blah. And you could say that looking at your TV and mm-hmm. that's your opinion. Yeah. I'm not saying my video is right and that it's not boring, except, you know, that's just what you think. And then I have to go and like read all of those comments. So yeah, it is tough. And I think going back to your original question, yes, you get more weird things because you're a woman, because you work in science, because you're trying to be an educator, but people don't take you seriously and all they want to do is comment about if you're wearing blush or yeah. if you have a new bra or whatever it may be. Like, people really focus on things like that. And then people write like, can you please not wear makeup because it distracts me when I'm watching it. And yeah, and it's like, I don't wear makeup to try and like look sexy. I wear it so I don't look dead. You know, there's like a bright light shining on my face and I need to have a bit of color in my cheeks or it just looks like I've died. Like, that is the goal here, is like to look somewhat alive. Like, I'm not wearing lipstick. I'm not wearing eyeshadow. Like, I'm just trying to get by.
It's so funny too how even I feel like when some guys, I'm not going to paint everybody with a broad brush, and I'm not going to say it's only men, but it's mostly
I think it would be a lot of women as well.
Yeah. But I definitely find that even when somebody is trying to compliment you, it just comes out. And that's always been a struggle for me when I go to these SciComm kind of convention, not conventions, but like these SciComm meetings and gatherings and symposia. And we have discussion sections and we talk about what it's like being a woman in science communication. And how do you deal with X? How do you deal with Y? And some say, oh, I use a pseudonym. Some say I never show my face. Others say, no, I'm loud and proud about it. I used to get a lot of guff for the name Talk Nerdy because it's like a double entendre. And it's like, oh, you're sexualizing it. And what the fuck are you doing for the movement? And like, oh my God, it's so complicated.
Yeah.
But there's some women who are just very rigid in SciComm about like, if a man says something that is harassment or that's insulting, I immediately block or I immediately retaliate or whatever the case may be. And I totally respect that. For yeah. me, I think it's important to try to understand intention. Mm-hmm. But it's hard because there is a difference, in my view, between somebody who's commenting in a way that's misguided
yeah,
and somebody who's commenting in a way that's like violent or aggressive and they know it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, is it my fucking job to like teach everybody on the internet manners? You know what I mean? It's exhausting.
I don't know if you could do that. No, I don't know if anyone could have that job.
You absolutely can.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's hard because a lot of the time when people write things that are like a bit mean or a bit offensive, sometimes I think, well, they're still entitled to be educated. They're still entitled like to learn about the content that I'm putting out. And I think it's different than where I'm an independent producer, but I'm backed by PBS. So I don't see myself as in a situation of just blocking every single person who says something kind of mean about me, because yeah. I'm like, well, just to clarify, my content does not come from tax dollars, but a lot of people have that perception that like they have earned the right to watch and everything. So I don't want to just block people.
Yeah. And that's a big question, right? Is like, how do you deal with the if you're not going to actively kind of engage or push back or block, and you're just going to kind of allow the flow to happen mm-hmm. naturally, how do you deal with it? I mean, especially somebody who does psychology videos, from a psychological perspective, do you have to ask yourself, am I in the mood today? Can I handle the comments? Or is this a day when maybe I shouldn't even bother reading because I'm not in like a headspace where it'll work for me?
Yeah, I think it's funny when you ask me how I deal with it, because honestly, I think a lot of the time I deal with it quite badly, where I get upset by it. Like I cry over things. Like it really, some things that people say are nasty and they really upset me. And sometimes I think like maybe I'm not cut for this. Like maybe I'm not built for being the person who puts their face on the internet and talking about things, but I have done it, and it's not something you can easily backtrack from. Like I can't take the 2 years back, and I wouldn't, because they've somewhat been better than they have been like mentally challenging. So I think you learn coping mechanisms. I wouldn't say to deal with things, but just to like make them different, I would say. So I used to get some comments to my email. YouTube updated their app once where they started sending me notifications all the time, and I mean all the time, when people were commenting, and I'm like, what is going on? So I put in a ton of filters. Like if anyone will comment accent, hair, piercing, like whatever they say, it'll just get picked up and it will just be hidden, which means they can still see it there, so they're not going to get angry thinking that I've deleted their comment, except no one else can see it.
Oh, that's so smart.
Yeah, so I have, I would say on all of my videos, like more comments hidden than actually made public. And every once in a while where I'm like, okay, it's time to do this, I'll go and I'll go through all of my hidden comments and I'll make some public or I'll delete some. And I kind of just started maybe a month or so ago, just deleting everything that was about my appearance, whether it was like good or bad, because I think the moment that you let comments like that become part of your community, the more people focus on it and the more they continue to comment about it. So I just kind of removed that because I was like, this isn't what I want. Like I'm not a lifestyle or beauty channel. Like I just want the comments to be about the science. And you can say that I'm wrong, you can say that I misinterpreted that study, but like just don't talk about my top. You know, like, you know, you can mention it, but I don't want you to talk about like how perky my boobs are this week, because that's not something that I want other people to be reading and thinking about.
And it does. And we know based on studies that the comments color the content of the piece of content, which is difficult. You know, two things that I want to say to that. The first one is I would not be surprised if everybody in your shoes felt the same way. Like, I don't know if I'm cut out for this. I don't know if I have the stamina. I don't know if you know, my strength of will is enough to – I think everybody has those crises, and everybody who does it is human.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
None of them are like – you know, robots. So I think that everybody goes through that, and it is absolutely the case that you are strong, and that's why you keep doing it. And I think that stopping and reflecting and having those actual real human reactions is actually a good thing. When those go away, then maybe it's time to be nervous. And the second thing I have to just ask is, why the fuck are people so obsessed with piercings?
Oh my, I don't know.
Every video I'm in, and I don't even have my own YouTube channel, but when I do TYT or I do these other, why do they talk about my lip ring so much? Why do they talk about your nose ring so much?
People are actually offended by piercings. Yeah, which is something that, I mean, I don't really understand, because I've had a nose ring since I was like 18 and lots of my friends have piercings or tattoos or whatever it may be, but people are honestly offended by them.
And then they love to talk about how, like, you'd be so much prettier if you didn't have that fish hook in
your
face.
Yes.
I don't understand. Like, why are you so obsessed with
it? Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's part of the reason. People have asked me before, why don't you make Talk Nerdy a video podcast? And I always tell them, well, there's actually two reasons. I don't say the first one as often as I should, which is that I'm fucking lazy. Like, do you know how much harder it is?
I don't think you're lazy.
Do you know how much harder it is to also have to roll video?
I know.
It's like so much easier when I'm in my workout clothes right now, because we met for brunch and I'd like half jogged there. And so I was like, yeah, I'm not going to be on camera looking like this. I'm a hot mess. But two, I don't want – this is the one place in my life where – because I'm in front of the fucking lens all the time. This is the one place where like I want us to be able to have a conversation and the whole comment section not be about our boobs.
Yeah.
Because it's unfortunate that as a woman, just being on camera opens you up to that. And and there's almost this weird kind of sensibility in the culture that like, well, you asked for that doing this kind of job. Like you signed up for that. So you'd better be ready to take it. And it's kind of like, it just reminds me of growing up Mormon and having these discussions where they would like basically teach you as a girl that you need to dress modestly because men can't control themselves and it's really the onus is on you, not on them. Mm-hmm. It's just this gross thing where it's like, well, how is that fucking my responsibility?
Yeah.
But that's kind of the culture we live in. Mm. Do you find that it's different now that you're in the US than it was when you, I guess you weren't really making YouTube content when you were in Australia, or were you for the government?
I did. Yeah, I did for, I would say, 6 months.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's no different because my audience has always been majority US, which really? Is one of the reasons why I also ended up living in the US or kind of moving to be with PBS and to continue making content with them. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't been any different, but I find that it changes as you grow a wider audience because people come in who aren't familiar with you and you do build up a community over time. But as you get bigger, more outsiders tend to come into that community. Yeah. So yeah, I think it is different being on the internet when you're not American or even British because a lot of people comment on your accent or they don't understand where in the world you come from or like why do you have a weird American British mix accent, like what the hell is wrong with you, you know? So like I think
people think you sound American British mixed together.
Yeah,
weird.
Yeah, maybe that is what Australian is.
Do you think I think so? I feel like kind you sound of quintessentially Australian.
Oh really?
Oh yeah, you have such an Australian accent.
I think the Australian accent is more like American and British mixed together. Mm. I do think
that there are parts of Australia, this is so broad brush, like we were talking about this at brunch, when I visited, you know, my N of one, because I spent a week there, I grew up in Texas, and I felt especially like Perth and mm-hmm. a little bit like Adelaide, where I was, and maybe even Brisbane a little bit, felt a little like Texas.
In what ways?
I don't know. Something about the people were really friendly, mm-hmm. Which is not always the case in the U.S. When you think about all the different cultural regions of the U.S., you know, the Northwest people are nice, but in a different way. The Northeast, obviously, people can be a little colder. D.C. area, people can be colder. L.A., it's a little more vapid. Like, you can think about that. There is something about the South that people talk about, this, like, Southern hospitality, but like a little bit of racism underneath it. And that's kind of what I noticed when I was spending a lot of time, especially in Perth. And maybe it's too, it's a little outdoorsy. It's very geological. It's like a mining and oil country.
Yeah,
a lot of engineers. It's just like the jobs there were very Texas. The people were very Texas. It didn't feel that different. And people fucking talk weird, right? They talk weird in Texas and they talk weird in Perth.
I think the thing is, there's not that much of a regional variation in the Australian accent. I think it's probably if you come from a country area, like a regional area, it might be a bit broader, mm-hmm. I think. And if you're from South Australia, you say like dance instead of dance and things like it. Because it has this weird like British New Zealand twang to it mm-hmm. when you're in South Australia. But other than that, yeah, there's not much difference. But I think in terms of the Texas vibe, people are a lot more friendly just outside of Sydney and Melbourne.
Could be. I
think.
And I didn't spend as much time in the big cities, weirdly.
Yeah, yeah.
I spent time in these like smaller big cities.
Yeah, and they do have the whole like oil and mining thing mm-hmm. going on in Western Australia, so that might be where that vibe comes from. I've never heard that comparison before.
And also
so it's so
barbecue heavy. Like just the food felt the same too. You know, it's like it's a meat and potatoes kind of country.
Australia's
like
very meaty.
I don't know. It just really felt like home. While I was there, I was like, oh, other than the insane plane ride here, I feel like I just went to Texas. Like, this works for me. I quite liked it. I live here.
Yeah.
Do you miss it?
I do. Yeah, I do. And it's the kind of thing where I don't know how long my little jaunt to the US will last for. Like, I think one of the downsides of my situation is that it always seems to be up in the air for different reasons. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes. Except, I mean, there's just things that I love about living in Australia, which seem so much easier than here. One of them is like the healthcare situation is just sorted. Like it's just great. You can just go to the doctor and it's free and like you can have anything done and you don't pay a cent for it. And there's something that is very comfortable about living in that situation. And maybe it's just because I've come from that situation and come to a place where healthcare is variable. Like you can pay for it, but you never know what you're going to get or how much things will cost or if things will be covered or not. And it's just the weirdest system. So I think like coming from complete security to this, like just, I don't know what it's just like a very insecure
Oh, you can say it. It's fucking terrible here.
Yeah, like, it's messed up.
It's really messed up.
It's messed up.
And so not to get too personal, I'm not going to say anything specific, and then you can if you want, or you can leave it very vague. You recently dealt with a health scare with somebody who you're quite close to. And so you've seen the system in action in a major way. Like in the kind of
definitely,
way that people could be potentially burdened by medical debt for the rest of their lives.
I know. Yeah. I mean, it blows my mind that you can go to a hospital to have an operation, but they can't even tell you how much it's going to cost until you've already had it and you could be getting a bill for like $200,000.
Yeah, you don't know. And they have to do all of the screenings and the tests and put you in the MRI, and a single MRI could cost $6,000.
But it's so variable. It could be $500 or it could be $6,000, and you don't know and they can't tell you. It blows my mind. So in Australia, there's still elective surgeries for things, or for example, dental isn't covered very well by the public system, so you still have to pay out of pocket for that. But if I wanted to go and like get my teeth cleaned, or if I had to get a wisdom tooth taken out, I could call the dentist. The standard prices for everything, and they're like, oh, you have like dental day surgery, that's going to be $1,500. And that is like the maximum you will ever have to pay for that. You have to pay it up front before you go in, like on the morning of kind of thing. And then they will take your wisdom teeth out and it's going to cost you that much money. And like, that is it. Whereas here, it's just kind of like, oh, you need to go in for dental day surgery. It could be $5,000 or it could be $20,000. We don't know.
And, so- and that's on top of the fact that you fully have paid your health insurance premiums. They are totally up to date. You've been responsible here.
And oh, gosh.
It's almost this idea of kind of like, we'll just do all of the medical shit up front, and then we'll just bill you until you die.
Yeah.
We'll just throw so many fees at you, and we will charge you out the ass. And knowing that half the people never actually pay anything off, we'll just hike everything up and bill everybody. And then you're just constantly in medical debt.
Yeah. So I think that stresses me out, just knowing that this system exists. And then I think there's differences between working in Australia and working in the US, where in Australia, the work day is shorter. There's a real emphasis on work-life balance, and people have a life outside of work. There's so many public holidays. You get at least 4 weeks paid vacation leave a year, like no matter what job you have.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I got 6 weeks because I used to work for the government.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's things like
that. You get 2 weeks here, and like usually that's if you're an executive or something.
Yeah.
It's like you have to have worked for the company for a while and they have to trust you. And again, how rare is it anymore that in the U.S. somebody has a, first of all, full-time secure job?
Yeah.
So many people are underemployed. So even though they have a job, they're part-time, which means their benefits are like null and void, or there's loopholes in their benefits.
Yeah. So I guess like the industrial relations laws are quite strong in Australia. There's a lot of unions there, which are much more commonplace than they are here. So you have a lot of paid sick leave. You have all kinds of like covers if you are injured or get sick long term and things like that. Like the government is just there for you. Yeah. They've got your back. Yeah. So you
we
know,
definitely have a distrust here in that way. Yeah. And oh gosh, you're here during like such a volatile election cycle too.
It is so bizarre. Yeah. And just the election cycle goes for so long. Oh my God.
That's another big difference in Australia. Am I mixing Australia up with New Zealand, or is it true that you guys have mandated voting?
No, we do. New Zealand does as well, I think.
New Zealand does also. Yeah, okay, so it's against the law. Like, you have to go and vote.
Oh, I've got a fine for not voting before because I was overseas.
Because you were working. That's amazing.
I was overseas and I got a fine, so I had to send my boarding pass in to the electoral board to prove that I couldn't vote. Yeah.
I so wish, you know, you see people trying to move for incremental change here. Like my friend Jacob Soboroff, he was an old co-host of mine on a show on Pivot. He's really heavily involved in this like Why Tuesday campaign, where they're asking like, why the fuck do we vote on a Tuesday? Like,
that is so weird. You vote on a weekend. Yeah, our elections are always on Saturday.
Yeah,
and
it doesn't make sense.
There's postal votes, and I think there's now online voting for certain things as well. So they make it very accessible for you to vote because they have to.
Because they need to.
Yeah.
It's like, not only do we vote on Tuesday, which is crazy, it's not a national holiday. although you get like Columbus Day off of work, like this fucking, you know, rapist, like smallpox infecting, like horrible imperialist, you know, for the government. But whatever, we take a day off to celebrate Christopher Columbus. But yet you can't get off of work if you have like a low skilled job or a job where you're not allowed to say like, hey, I'm going to go vote.
Yeah.
Like that doesn't always happen. So it's a Tuesday. There's a million barriers to vote. Mm-hmm. There's the system is stacked, as we've seen before, both legislatively, but also with lots of loopholes to try to prevent disenfranchised people from voting. I mean, we have a long history of terrible voter fraud in this country and a long history of trying to disenfranchise voters that aren't rich white men.
Yes.
So we struggle with that in this country. And it's not good for democracy. Also, our campaign seasons are crazy long.
This is what I mean about the process and like the primaries and everything. Like, I think I saw on, it was on a late night show, like possibly John Oliver after the Canadian elections. They were saying that the Canadian election season goes for like 100 days or something like that. Like from start to finish, that is their campaign, the election, like the process of them being sworn in or whatever. Like that is how long it goes for. I mean, fact check that, it could be a bit longer, but it was so short. But in comparison,
it's got a beginning and an end.
Yes.
Whereas here, because we have no campaign finance reform, we have no good legislation around campaign finance. If anything, the laws that are in place to keep it as loose as possible. What you end up, like Citizens United allowing, you know, corporations to fund campaigns in a major way, what you end up with is a profit motive. A heavy profit motive to campaign as often as possible, to beg constituents for money as often as possible, to try and basically he who pays the most, or she now, who pays the most, hopefully is the winner. Like that's been the formula for so long, and it's bullshit. It's like an absolute mockery of the democratic process. And so I look at countries like Australia, I think, as very wise. And it's funny because culturally in America, you see this kind of, it's like reverse snobbery around Europe. It's like liberals are into Europe, you know? It's like it's such a conservative thing to be like, oh, we don't want to be like the Europeans. Like it's all debauchery over there and they don't know what the fuck they're doing. And it's like, well, at least look to the Australians then. It's not Europe. Like look to the Australians and see how they're doing it. It's not just Europe. It's just other developed democracies.
Yeah, I feel like America could learn a lot about gun control from Australia. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they have good examples in that sense. But as much as I love Australia, they have their own weird political dramas as well. Like, we've had something like 5 prime ministers in the past 4 years.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a downfall of our system. And I find that people get really personal about politics in the US because you're voting for one person. You're supporting that person. Whereas in Australia, it's much more party focused, whereas you vote for a party more so than a person. And because of that, the party has the power to elect a new leader if they're not happy with how the current one is doing. So that's happened like every year for the, since like I think 2010, where the party, like if somebody has a bad approval rating and then there's like the vice, what's it called, the deputy prime minister or someone else in the party has a better rating, they're like, oh, well, you know, it's coming up to the election next year. Let's just put them as prime minister for the next like 10 months to see if they can get reelected. Like it's been so weird where we've had all of these leadership spills because somebody like has just made one wrong policy choice and they've been ousted as the leader of the party.
You really can't oust, like if somebody wins the election, especially if we're talking about like the executor, right? Like your prime minister, our president. If somebody wins the election, we're stuck with them for 4 years unless, you know, we can impeach them, which they have to have basically broken the law or done something that was like not in duty to the office.
Uh-huh.
You can't just be like, people don't really like you that much. Like if they elected Trump, I think it would be easy to impeach him because like he's already promised to break many laws. He's already basically promised to be a war criminal, which is kind of like, don't think that'll go over very well.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's weird. Oh gosh, you're getting a firsthand of like,
I know.
What? Do people in Australia, I mean, I know you still have a lot of friends there, your family still lives there, your roots really are still in Australia.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Do they think that it's like a fucking joke what's going on here right now?
Not necessarily my family, but the country of Australia as a whole thinks it's a bit of a joke. And I'm just judging this from the media. So I visit quite often, and I was in Australia last month, and all they want to do is report on Donald Trump. Like, they are fascinated and amused by Donald Trump. And it's really interesting because while I was there, I think Bernie won like 6 out of 7 of the primaries in a row. It was when he was on his liberal state streak. So he was doing really well. And personally, I mean, I'm more like left swinging, but I think that that is a far better story to report than like Donald Trump's saying stupid shit at rallies. But that is all the media wants to report on. And so every day, like on the radio or in the newspaper, there's just a new guess what Donald Trump said today story in Australia. And that is all they're reporting on. I mean, you might have like the ABC or the public media reporting on Trump and then saying, oh, and Bernie Sanders won this or something, but, or Hillary won this, but there's no real story there other than let's talk about Donald Trump again, because isn't he interesting? And when I went to, you know, barbecues and things when I was at home, all my friends are like, so is Donald Trump like really a thing? Because people are just shocked. And I think some people have the same reaction here, where at first people thought he was just trolling and he's like a megalomaniac or something and he's not really running for president. And then he started winning all of the primaries and everyone's like, what? Wait, is he really going to be the president? Could he be the president? Is this something that could happen? So Australia, when I was there, the media is very much in that, okay, Donald Trump cycle, where they just want to report on like how weird that is.
And I feel like tonally the media here has started to shift, because probably what you see in Australia, I think, is what we saw all over the media early on during the election cycle, right? It's like, oh, fucking idiot Trump said this other thing. Isn't that hilarious? And then, like you said, as he started to really gain momentum, you're starting to see a shift where in the media now there's almost this kind of fear and like embarrassment. Like, there's a shame, a level of shame written into the articles that didn't exist at the beginning, when it was easy to kind of be like, oh, look at that idiot, you know, oh, other. Like, it's other. It's very like, haha, what a funny show. And then when it starts to get closer and closer to having real consequences, you know, Australia can keep reporting it and going, ha, look what's going on in the States. Oh, my God, that's embarrassing. But here we're like, oh, fuck, this could be our lie. It's like something to really be concerned about.
Hey, guys, I just want to take a quick moment to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, OVAudioVideo.com. If you're a UAV pilot, and for those of you who don't know, that is an unmanned aerial vehicle, or in common parlance, drone, you've got to visit OVAudioVideo.com. They offer the most reliable and cost-effective equipment available for wireless HD video and audio transmission. And it doesn't stop there. Whether you're a hobbyist or a pro, whether you're building your own robot or you're doing your own broadcasting like I do right here, OVAudioVideo.com is for you. There's even a blog right there on the site to help you hone your craft. And right now, for a limited time, only for you guys, the Talk Nerdy listeners, you get 10% off your entire order when you use the coupon code TALKNERDY. That's all one word. So what are you waiting for? Visit OVAudioVideo.com today and snag yourself some great new drone accessories, robotics accessories, even broadcast accessories like wireless receivers and transmitters, RF amplifiers, and even surveillance equipment at the best prices around. And don't forget to use the coupon code TALKNERDY for 10% off. So what are you waiting for? Visit OVAudioVideo.com today. That's OVAudioVideo.com. All right, let's get back to the show.
And so what is your so I'm always fascinated by like these weird logistical questions. Bear with me, listeners, as if you care. You were talking about having to get a social security card.
Yeah,
you were talking about having to get credit when you first moved here. Are you here on a work visa? Are you getting a green card? Do you have a green card? Like, what's your status in the U.S.?
Sure. I'm here on a work visa. Okay. So that is the thing that is always uncertain because it's inherently tied to your job, which is like secure-ish.
Well, and also, you know, can you maintain a work visa if you're fully freelance?
Mine is a bit of a different class.
Gotcha.
So I can, but I can only accept money from like certain companies, basically. So I can't like, it's weird because I'm freelance, except I'm very narrowly freelance for like one company.
You're
like a contractor.
You're a contractor for PBS Studios.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they basically have to fill out paperwork that you then have to send to the Australian government that says, like, I'm continuously employed, even though it's basically through my personal corp or however you're doing
it. Yeah,
yeah, gotcha. Yeah. And so when you said that you needed a Social Security card, is that so that you can do things like lease a car and get a rent or
just
a mortgage?
So I can get paid.
Oh, so you
actually... Yeah, you can't get paid without a Social Security number. But something that I found quite weird is that you can't do a lot of things without a Social Security number. And it made me think quite a lot about how undocumented people like survive. Like, how do they do anything? Like, I couldn't get my electricity connected in my first apartment without a Social Security number. Because I guess when you think about it, they're providing you with the service that they expect you to pay at the end of the month or so. And they like, you don't exist in their system. So they were like, oh, well, you need to pay us upfront for like 3 months worth of electricity based on what the past tenant in your apartment was paying. And it's like, are you kidding?
Oh,
geez. So it's like stuff like that. Like, you have to get a prepaid phone because no one will give you a phone plan. You have to like buy your own handset outright because no one will give you anything. Like, the proudest moment of living here was when I got approved to lease a car, because I'd been trying for like 2 years to build up my credit rating, and all of a sudden like I got approved. And I mean, it wasn't easy. This is the thing, like with anything that you do, you have to provide like all of your income history for the past like 5 years, because because when you have a limited credit history, like, you can never have a really great rating.
Yeah,
like,
so you
even if you're perfect,
fill in as many gaps as
possible. Yeah. So, I mean, everything that you do, it's like, oh, you're conditionally approved because, you know, you have a good score, but like, it's limited. So where have you been before you were here? Give us all of your information.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of hard. Like, you realize how much you don't exist when you don't have one. And then I really feel bad for people who have terrible credit rating, because like, how can they do anything? And the thing that really blew my mind with my car lease as well was that if you have a lower score, it's going to be more expensive per month.
Yeah.
And I was like,
it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I'm like, it's a product that I'm like paying for. How can you charge me more if I'm like bad with money? And people are trying to explain it to me like, oh, but you're a higher risk, so you have to pay more money. And I'm like, it's like a product. It's like me going to buy a car and my car's like $30,000. And they're like, oh, sorry, you have a bad credit rating. You're going to have to pay $34,000 for this car. It's like, how does this make any sense?
Yeah, like not only is the price of the car not variable, it costs what it costs.
Yeah.
But also, it's backward from reality.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of these things where, from the creditor's perspective, I guess you can start to understand, well, if they're higher risk, we can expect them to pay more. And then that way, if they flake, we have more of a buffer. But at the same time, the reason that they're higher risk is because they're generally lower income, and it's because
I don't even understand.
So it's like the rich people pay less, and the poor people pay
more. And I just don't understand. And my car insurance is cheaper because I have a master's degree.
Yeah.
I'm like, what is that about? Like, oh my God. It really blows my mind. And the thing is that I've never leased a car in Australia, so I'm not really sure if that is how it works. But there's certain situations like that where I'm like, it can't be like this in other countries. Like, please write to Cara if it is like this in other countries, because like, I can't even imagine that it would be.
It's also one of those things where you would think that the U.S. government, having such strong allies with certain other democratic societies like England, like Australia, like, we've always been an ally with Australia. Like, that's not going to change, right? You would think that there would be some sort of nation-to-nation background check or something, you know, where it's like, you don't have to just prove to me that you exist, like, that you can be like, well, this is my Australian history, so just run that card.
Yeah, it's interesting because you can get it's like almost an international credit check. Like, there's certain agencies that where you give them like your tax file number in Australia, that will kind of pull up your history and give you some kind of international score. It's kind of like, having an international driver's license. Yeah. Like you can go and like get a little piece of paper that says you can drive in other countries from like your local DMV or whatever, but it's not really accepted all the time. So it's like becomes weird where it's like a guide for someone, I guess, gotcha. Except they will often just want like your US history and everything. So yeah, it's really hard, but I think like I had saved up some money to come over here, which enabled me to, I had to pay like 6 months upfront rent. I had to pay upfront for my electricity. Like I when I say I saved up money, it was like gone immediately.
Yeah.
And I
and
was
we're
just
talking like tens of thousands.
Yeah. And I'm just like, well, how do people with families survive? How do people who again are undocumented do anything? Like I guess in those situations, there are families and communities who might support certain people coming from certain countries in a way.
And then it's almost like you're incentivized to break the law. I mean, yeah. I dated a guy once and he was English. Like he wasn't even, you know, he could speak the language.
Yeah.
He was very savvy and crafty, but he like lived in a hostel. He basically worked under the table at a restaurant and was paid in cash.
Yeah.
And that's somebody who's basically at less risk, I think, mm-hmm. of deportation. He's oh, yeah. left because he was like, you know, I mean, he was Hispanic looking ish, but like for the most part, like a white guy. He's just yeah. a white English guy with the yeah. accent and like, oh, okay. But especially if you're somebody who came over from Latin America,
yeah.
and you're somebody who doesn't speak English very well, your support system is back in your home country
mm-hmm.
and you're trying to work hard to both support yourself and to support family back home. Like, oh my fucking God.
I know. Like it blew my mind. And sometimes like I have these moments of crisis where I have like a meltdown over my visa or something. And I'm like, what if something happened to my show or my job or something? I would have like 30 days to leave the country. But like, I'm legally allowed to be here. Like, yeah. how do people feel where it's like day to day uncertain, like anything could happen to them? Like, I can't even imagine how stressful that must be.
And it's like having that perspective that you have about how much stress you're carrying every day. And
but I'm so fortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like having that perspective. And then you hear people, especially like the super right wing, like not the moderates, like the ultra right wing politicians here in this country, literally, and it's not just our country, like it's everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
You see it talking about, oh, immigrants are fucking lazy, immigrants are like saps on the system,
mm-hmm.
like immigrants are all drugged, and it's like, you are so horrible.
Yeah, but they're so out of touch with
exactly.
reality.
They're out of
yeah.
touch. That's what it is.
Yeah.
You've never walked a day in somebody else's shoes.
And I think especially in the US, like the country wouldn't survive without undocumented people doing the jobs at the kind of rates that US citizens probably wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's crazy to think about. But it's funny that you talk about your English boyfriend because mm-hmm. in Australia there is the same conversation about refugees and about immigrants as there is here, I would say. And there are more English people that have overstayed holiday visas every
yeah.
year than there are people trying to seek asylum in Australia from war-torn countries.
Yeah, and it's like –
and no one talks
cares
about
them.
Yeah.
Right? They're like, oh,
because
yeah, they're
white.
Like us.
Yeah.
Exactly. They're,
yeah.
Oh, but they're upstanding citizens. And like this kid was not an upstanding citizen. Like, I can tell you that. Like, that's why I say I used to date a guy. And he's very sweet. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
we're still maybe not so much in touch, but, like, definitely not a model citizen by
yeah,
any stretch
yeah.
of the imagination. Definitely, like, seedy things where it's like, I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to know. It's true. It's a hard situation to be in.
Yeah.
So you mentioned before, okay, before you did the digital series, Braincraft,
mm-hmm.
you were, A, working for the Australian government, but
yeah.
in a SciComm capacity, right?
Yes, yeah.
What was your official title? What did you do?
I had many titles.
Uh-huh.
So I worked for the federal government for 6 years for an agency called CSIRO, which is like the Federal Science Agency in Australia. And I started working for them as a undergraduate. Is that too many grads in one sentence? When I finished my bachelor's
there
degree.
You go. That
makes yeah.
sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I started working for them when I finished my bachelor's degree in education and outreach. So I did a Bachelor of Science and I studied psychology. Like I majored in psychology and I also studied biology and neurobiology and basically just did like 3 years of statistics. And then I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I did an internship with them in their education program. So we're talking to kids about science. We have workshops. We do like liquid nitrogen shows and dry ice shows, and it was fun. Like, I really liked science and I enjoyed talking to people, and I was like, this is cool, I want to do this. So I was lucky enough to get a position with them because I was in a team of like 10 people who did that in Sydney, and like, that's it basically. So yeah, so I think my internship went really well, and like, I just kind of fell into that. There was a position open. I think about luck a lot, and I think I was in the right place at the right time, but I also worked very hard to be in that place, and I was like ready to take an opportunity. So it all kind of worked out like that. Yeah. So I worked in Sydney and around New South Wales in education and outreach, and we taught programs from kindergarten to senior year high school across every area of science.
Oh, wow.
So in no way did my education ever prepare me for that. Because all of a sudden I'm doing a chemistry show for like year 11, which are like 16-year-olds or 17-year-olds.
They know a lot.
They know more than me, really, because I never took chemistry, and it was like past high school, and it was never a strong suit for me. So I did physics shows for seniors as well. So I'm like reading textbooks and like studying. It's like I'm taking, basically, I didn't think online courses were like as popular then, but I have like old books, and there was definitely Wikipedia. Like, I'm reading physics Wikipedia pages, and the things that we did were very specific. Like, we would do a show on force and motion. So I would do like a crash course on force and motion for like a week or 2 weeks before I did this program. So
how fun though that you get the opportunity to keep learning. Like, it's very rare that you're almost externally forced to learn something new.
I know. And I think like it was, I'm glad I did it when I was younger, because I feel like now it would stress me out a lot more, because we're in a sense going into a school as an expert, and I'm like doing a crash course in the topic beforehand. So we would have people who were more specialized towards like biochem physics in our team who would do certain things, except you had to learn every program in case they couldn't do it. And I think the benefit that we brought to the school was equipment that the school didn't have, and we would make science fun in like a 2-hour period in a way that the teachers can't, because they're constrained by the curriculum. And all of our things were like curriculum supported, but they were just like really hands-on and fun, and we would bring like whiz-bang stuff that they didn't have in schools. So that was really cool. So I did that for a while, and because they were a federal agency, I had the opportunity to move around the country and work in different states doing similar things. Like, I went to the Northern Territory, which is like an amazing place to live, and I went to North Queensland and lived on the Great Barrier Reef for 18 months, and I was like weirdly nomadic, and I discovered all of the like beautiful World Heritage areas that Australia has through being a science educator, I guess. Like, it was really cool. And then I ended up moving back to Sydney to work in the media team. And I started some social media accounts for them, and we had a really fun social media presence for a government agency. Like, we kind of looked at NASA and the way that they have accounts for like spacecrafts and missions and everything, and tried to model work we were doing off them.
It's very smart to give a rover a personality and tweet in first person.
Yeah, and we support a lot of those space activities in Australia through radio telescopes in the Southern Hemisphere and things like that. So we did work with the NASA teams from time to time for like certain launches and things like that. So yeah, that was really cool. So I was like a social media advisor and a spokesperson. So I did like breakfast TV and radio interviews and things like that on behalf of the science agency, purely because they just wanted someone young to do things like that as well. So I think it was perfect for me, because I got to do all of the fun interviews. And whenever there was something about like budget cuts or like Senate hearings and things, like the chief executive always had to go on and do those ones. So I got like the good end of the stick. Yeah. I got to do all of the like, hey, this is the cool research that we're doing in this area deal. And then I never had to deal with any of like the fallout, or I had scripted answers to avoid questions if they asked about budget cuts, because I like wasn't allowed to talk about them. Yeah. So,
and probably maybe wouldn't have been the best person to talk about.
Who wants like a 27-year-old talking about like budget cuts? I don't know.
Let's see what happens when we put this chrysanthemum in liquid nitrogen.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So it was really fun. And I started getting into YouTube through them. Like, we launched a video series on YouTube, and I was producing online content for them. And that kind of opened up my eyes to the world of what was possible via video. And I really started wanting to do more in that space. But I was kind of like limited in my role, and I I'd been there for 6 years, so I was like, it's probably time to try something on my own and to like go out into the big bad world and even go overseas and just like see where this takes me.
Well, and I mean, A, what a good way to prime yourself. You know, how much good experience, learning, you know, if you have to start 10 social media accounts for 10 things,
yeah,
it's only going to make you better at your own if you're already figuring out the back end of YouTube mm-hmm. for your government. But it's true. I mean, as much as it must be such an honor and so exciting to represent your own country, you're representing your country.
Yeah.
You can't just say what comes to your mind.
Oh,
you
no.
Yeah, it's like and you have to watch what you say every time you open your mouth.
Yeah. But I think that's something that I enjoy more, having my own personality on BrainCraft and being able to reply to comments and things, because we had, I mean, they were all like implemented by myself and my colleagues, but mm-hmm. we would have procedures of how to reply to someone. And if somebody was saying something nasty, you would have to like screenshot it and save it in this folder and send them so many nice replies before we would have an actual meeting about whether to block them or not. You know, like there's so many policies and procedures in place about how you deal with people because you're representing the government.
Like, fuck you.
Yes, I know. So now like in, you know, nicer way, now I have the power to do that.
Yeah.
And I think it's good like transferring over to PBS because I'm still mindful of like the larger body that I'm somehow like representing, but I can kind of do my own thing, which is like really, really nice. But I think what like the best learning experience from what I did was actually when I was in classrooms with the kids, mm-hmm. because I think now I'm in a somewhat similar situation where I'm delivering content every week that's going out to people who are professors in certain fields. Like they have PhDs in something really specific that I happen to be doing a video on that week. And there are people who will always know more about a topic than I do.
Yeah.
And I'm back in like senior chemistry doing a show where I'm like trying to bring information in a way to people who are a bit more experienced than I am. I mean, in the case of BrainCraft, these people are like a lot more experienced in the science of it. But I have to find like a business, I have to find my unique selling point. Like, how can I do this in a way that will benefit them that other people with a year 10 science education will also understand? And it's hard to like find a balance in that. And the other thing that I think I learned from my time in the classroom as well was just how to answer questions. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of a show, you get questions about anything and everything and things that I don't know anything about. And you have to find like a certain formula and like certain things to bring into your answer, almost like a politician does, to make somebody feel satisfied that you have answered their question, but when you actually have no idea what the answer is.
But I have to say, I so appreciate that even just now you said like things that I don't know the answer to. Like, I love it when people can admit that.
Yeah.
I feel like that's something we're lacking sort of in US science education mm-hmm. and the culture of science here. There's a hubris to kind of, well, if I'm in a position of authority or I'm in a position of educational prowess, that somehow I have to pretend like I have an encyclopedic knowledge about yeah. everything. And especially when you were in the position working for the government, I used to work as the science correspondent at HuffPost, and it was not the same, but a similar thing where my background is neuroscience and psychology, right? Mm-hmm. Similar to yours. But all of a sudden, I'm writing articles about space.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fuck, I don't know anything about this. And so you do your due diligence and you do your research, but then you find yourself on panels or you find yourself yeah. in a position where somebody's like, but what about this? And you have to be able to say, I have no idea. I can find out.
Yeah.
I would love to research that with you, for you. I can help find an expert on that and we can talk about it. But like the minute that you start hemming and hawing and trying to pretend like you know the yes. answer when you don't,
yeah.
is the minute you lose all trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so few people get that.
Yeah.
Even when growing up in the school systems here, I can't tell you how often I think that children have the experience of asking their teachers something, and good teachers will say, who don't know, and good teachers who know will help you answer. Good teachers who don't know will say, you know, I'm not sure, but I bet we could learn together and then yeah. get up with you. But that, I think, is more the exception than the rule.
Yeah, I think the key to answering a good question like that I learned is just knowing the best place to go,
yeah.
which could mean knowing a little bit about what different universities are studying, knowing different agencies that do like weather research or that do geology stuff, like kind of knowing a good spot to go and just knowing a lot of really general information. Mm-hmm. So if you ask me a very specific question, as kids often do, or even as people on the internet often do, you can say, gosh, well, here's a general fact, but to look into that further, you probably want to go to and talk to like this team, this agency, because they will tell you X, Y, and Z, and I really hope that helps you out. I'd love to know what you find. And like that is a nice kind of like formula that you can
work
through.
Yeah, that's really smart because you still satisfy something. They're not walking away going, well, that didn't help at all.
Yeah, it's like she knows something.
Yeah, so it's like not only did you answer something that I didn't know and I have a new tidbit I'm walking away with, but now I get to further my curiosity by following up and researching on that website or whatever. Yeah. I also love that you said A to Z because that's so Australian. I love it.
Well, it's like you have like a little tidbit of knowledge, but you have a job. Like you need to go and like find something out. So you have a purpose.
Totally, yeah. Which I love. You know, but there are also those times when you just get frustrated when somebody's like, what's the difference between this and that? Like they ask questions that are so, and it's like, Google it.
Yeah.
Understand. Like, you know how you can tell the difference between genuine curiosity and somebody who's like, I've been thinking about this thing and what do you think about XYZ? And you're like, oh, that's interesting. Let's think about it together. Or somebody where it's so obvious that they're like asking you to do their science homework.
Yeah.
And you're like, hey kid, I see right through the shit. Like you're doing your own homework.
But I think it's interesting when people are just curious and I want your opinion on something because I think it's really hard being, as you would know as well, like being a host of a show where you have to cover a number of different topics and you have to research and prepare for all of them. And people are like, oh, I saw that you said that you read this book in this episode and I just want to know what you think about this very specific thing. And you're like, oh my God, I have to read like 150 books a year. And you're like, and you're like, I don't want to admit this, but I often skim them to find things relevant to what I'm talking about because it's like a time kill.
Or even if you did absolutely read that, you're like, that I have slept 40 times since then. That literally completely left my brain.
Well, it's like I've done 20 other stories since then, and like I wish I had an unlimited capacity to store everything, except I get foggy on things. And I'm like sitting there and I'm like, oh, presence. I read that book by what was her name, Amy someone, and then you come and you're like, oh, and it kind of comes back to you and people are staring at you like, what is wrong with you?
you're like accessing computing.
So I think it's really hard when because you represent this area of science on YouTube or for a broadcast or because you put yourself out there as a personality, people think you're like a human encyclopedia and you're like, I'm just another person who's really busy and stressed and I can't answer every question.
Speaking of how busy and how stressed you have been, tell me a little bit for those who are listening, what are some of the most recent videos that you've done? Like what are some that you were especially proud of? What are you working on right now? Like what can we get excited about with BrainCraft?
I'll go in like chronological order. So I'll tell you some that I've just done and some that are coming up. Mm-hmm. So I did at the beginning of March, if you have a look on BrainCraft, I did a number of episodes with YouTube. They had initiative for people through the space in LA to apply for a crew and things like that to support them. So
nice.
I did that. And yeah, because I normally work by myself and all of a sudden I was like, what could I do with like 10 people?
Yeah,
like
it was, resources.
Yeah. So I was like trying to figure out what to do. So I did two episodes as part of this program with YouTube. One is called The Nature of Memory. And they had a 4-room set, the YouTube space that was a condition of this program. You had to use it. And I was like, I just talk to a still camera. Like, what can I do? So I actually used, you may have heard of the memory palace. It's like a memory technique from ancient Greece that helps people, for example, like memorize a deck of cards. Like if you wanted to memorize a deck of cards in your house, you might put a certain suit in one room or certain cards in other rooms.
We're
and then you mentally walk through your house to like remember different cards, for example.
So this was literally just a topic of conversation on the Skeptics Guide this week.
Oh, like, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So And they were talking about how they took a mnemonic class when they were kids, the brothers, and that they still remember to this day, like, which president hung out in which, like, cupboard.
Oh my gosh. That's funny. I mean, it's been around for thousands of years, which I think is so cool in science, because we are just evolving constantly and developing new theories and techniques. But this one has, for whatever reason, like, just held true for thousands of years, and it just works.
It really taps into this, like, core hippocampal area where we just, without even trying, develop such good kind of procedural and geographic memory.
Yeah, that if you can utilize, we have this like spatial tendency to like want to, I guess, like put things in places.
Yeah,
we just categorize things,
because I guess there's a huge evolutionary advantage to knowing where, you know, it's after that one tree and don't go past the boundary of that one cliff and blah, blah, blah. So if you can do that with discrete objects that are harder to remember, like things that almost don't connect to anything else, you're giving it a connection.
Yeah, yeah.
Smart.
So I did an episode called The Nature of Memory that just explored what memory is and how memories form and the nature of forgetting and things like that. I mean, very superficially, it was like 4 minutes. And I did it moving through the rooms of the house. So on a meta level, I used the memory palace to kind of walk through and remember the script, because I had to remember 4 minutes worth of dialogue in one take. It was like a Birdman style thing where I had a moving camera behind me that
went offset.
Maybe six.
You only did six or seven times, and you got a really good take out of it.
Yeah, I had to hide some. I could hide some cuts in a few places.
That's good. And they do that too. You see it when they almost like going super tight on something or going past a post.
I hit the camera. Like I walk past the camera and would like hit the camera. And there's one of them that I think is quite obvious, but I don't think other people noticed as much, because people are commenting. They're like, is this one take?
That's so
cool. Which it was, except we just had to split it up a few times because some bits were better than others. So so I did that one video, which it was a good experiment for me because I'd never worked with a moving camera like that before. So it was like really interesting. And I had different memory cues in all of the different rooms. Like I would have a book in one place or a post-it note in another or a deck of cards somewhere or a picture in a frame or a tape recorder or like a photo album. Like I would have all of these like props that were cues for me to start talking about new things that I would move around to and use. So it was like, it was somewhat interesting because I was using memory techniques to talk about memory. So that was one of them. The other video I did is called The Tiny Key to Aging. And it's about telomeres. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard of those. But it was really cool because I did a stop motion animation, which I normally do kind of by myself. But this time I was able to work with another professional animator. I consider myself some kind of like weird hobbyist who does animations in my home. And the biggest, I think, empowering moment of working in this program was that I worked with another animator who I realized is so similar to me. And she's a professional that does ads and like Instagram videos for brands and things like that. And I was like, wow, I'm like kind of a professional. I had never thought of myself like that before.
If you get paid, you're a professional.
Yeah. And since I met her, she's referred me some like, you know, 15 second ads for like Jack in the Box and things like that that I've done. And
very
I've like,
cool.
I have done things outside, like somewhat outside of my like main gig, which makes me feel more like more of a professional.
That's
anyway,
awesome.
We did this like 3 minute stop motion animation together, which is really cool. And it was basically about the life and work of Elizabeth Blackburn, who is an Australian biologist. And she's the first and only Australian woman to have ever won a Nobel Prize. And she's at the Salk Institute in San Diego at the moment. So I actually had the pleasure of having a Nobel laureate fact check my script.
That's amazing.
Yeah, because I interviewed her and I explained the nature of the interview and what I was using it for, the animation and everything. And she was like, oh, have you written something? And I was like, oh, yeah, I have like a draft script. And she's like, well, I'd like to see it. So I gave it to her and she's just going through and like crossing things off. And like, it was very collaborative. And she's like, oh, well, you shouldn't use this word. I want you to now use this other word. And I was like, sure. Anyway, so I didn't actually end up interviewing her because it just became this like,
that's hilarious.
This live editing process of her going through my script. It,
was, it
was really
biographical.
Funny.
Like she was helping you. So she was autobiographical. I love that.
Yeah. So that was really fun to do, just to get to work with another animator and to actually deal with her firsthand.
Yeah.
So yeah. So they're two really interesting ones that I would recommend to go and see. And at the moment I have just gotten to the end of what I consider bulk shooting, which is being like 1 week ahead.
Yeah. And this episode, I'm 1 week ahead on this episode. You're actually going to air not tomorrow, which is very common for me on a Sunday.
Yes,
but you're going to air in a week.
Great.
Which is awesome.
You have like a whole week.
I know, because I banked another. I got to do a follow-up with Neil Shubin.
Oh,
so
cool.
Anybody listening right now will have gotten that episode last week.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm in a period now where the next book I'm kind of planning and writing a lot more content, and I'm actually working with some other writers now, which is like so amazing for my life and for the quality of my content as well. So I have an episode coming up on multitasking and on food sounds and how the sound of food relates to your psychology of experiencing it and your appetite and things like that. Yeah.
So like the sound of it cooking or the sound of it when you eat it or both?
Both.
Because that's two different.
The sound of the packaging, the sound of it cooking, and the sound of it going through your mouth.
Like how stale chips are nutritively no different, but they don't feel right. Even though they taste the same, they don't feel right because they don't crunch in your brain in a way. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And then the mouth sounds really gross me out.
Yeah.
What was that? Somebody was recently talking about, this might have been on Skeptic's Guide too. I have such a fucking bad memory. I feel like somebody was recently, my friend Nick Juhas, who does a YouTube show called Nickopedia.
Oh.
And he did an episode about like there's some sort of disorder where, or I don't know if I would call it a disorder, but where people have like a hyper negative response to like mouth noises.
Oh.
And I feel like I have that. Like when I hear somebody eating or if I'm watching TV and there's a scene where two people start making out and it's like mic'd really heavily, I get like nauseous.
Wow.
Do you have that?
No, I didn't even know that that was crazy. A thing. But thank you for bringing it to my attention.
I'm like somebody who's like chewing on like macaroni and cheese.
Yeah.
And he was talking about why there might be an evolutionary reason that that would
exist.
And then I was thinking, how weird. Oh, we talked about this on the podcast. I was like, but in certain cultures, like in Japan, it's like an honor if you like slurp your ramen.
Yeah, how do you go with ramen? I was thinking of ramen.
I don't eat ramen appropriately, probably. Like I would probably insult the chef.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, so am I, and I don't like to eat it appropriately. And I go with my boyfriend, and he is like a slurp monster. Like his ramen, what do you call it? Like
etiquette?
Broth, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Like ramen broth will go everywhere, like all over the entire table. It'll go on me. He'll be like slurping out of control. And like, it's gotten to the point where I don't like going to ramen with him because I'm like, can you stop? Like,
it's so gross.
Yeah. And I think I would eat my ramen like I would eat spaghetti probably. And I don't like to slurp because the water then goes all over my face.
No,
and I find that like weirdly uncomfortable having a ramen face.
And also it like sounds gross.
Yeah.
Like it's a gross. So how do you handle when you come with us to Hot Pot?
Hot pot was fine.
Good.
I didn't, like, I don't have any memories of mouth sounds at Hot Pot.
That's good. The tables are often big, which is nice.
Yeah,
you're a little far away from each other, close enough that you can have a nice intimate conversation. Hot Pot, we always joke, is not a place to take like a first date.
Yeah.
It's kind of where you want to go when you are already pretty close to someone. Because A, the rule is you have to go in pajamas or some sort of comfortable clothes. Like if you're dressed up at Hot Pot, fuck you. Fuck you. You need to be comfortable. And your clothes reek afterwards. So you have to remember that. And then B, it just like, there's just always snot. Like when you're eating, because it's so spicy and like it's just steamy and delicious. And but there's always just kind of a level of snot.
Yeah,
that
I feel
happens.
Like it's not as slurpy though because you have different food. Like you don't have a lot of liquid. Like you have a small amount of broth, but it's mostly to cook rather than to eat, right?
Yeah, if that's
and
how
then,
you eat it.
Yeah, and you have noodles, except you have more like proteins and vegetables.
Yeah,
and
we do a lot
like
of
that.
Veggies. Like when I go to Hot Pot, I actually eat vegetarian, which is rare for me because it's something about having like raw meat on the table and then cooking it and then eating it. It's like all I can think about is what it looked like raw and then I don't want it. So I eat mostly veg there, but it's definitely, it's just a very snotty experience.
It is, I feel, I mean, ramen is the same.
Yeah, especially if you go super spicy with the ramen.
Hot
Pot's my favorite. I'm so glad that you come to Hot Pot. We got to do it more often.
Yeah, I love Hot Pot.
It's the best.
Yeah.
And it's like such a good nerd outing. Guys, if you have Hot Pot in your if you don't know what I'm talking about, Google it because I don't want to explain it. But it's really good. It's from the Sichuan region in China. It's very spicy. It's delicious. If you live in a big town, you'll have it. If you don't,
you cook things in boiling water that is full of spices.
Full of spices. And
it's like Korean barbecue underwater.
Yeah. And it's a little like shabu shabu. It's slightly different because it's Chinese, not Japanese. I think shabu shabu is Japanese.
It is Japanese,
It's just so good.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, it's become a real bonding moment for like the Nerd Brigade and for like all of my nerdy friends in LA. And so it's just where you go. And I mean, remember when we were at Hot Pot the other week? It was like, I feel like anybody eavesdropping on our conversations would be like, what a bunch of fucking nerds.
But also, like, we talk about nerdy things, and then I feel like it just kind of delves into therapy.
It does.
Yeah. It's like
therapy with like big words.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's like, let's talk about science news or something, and let's like correct each other's grammar, and then let's just have like an emotional breakdown.
About
like all in 45 minutes. Yeah.
Like everybody's a science communicator freelancer, and we're all like, I'm never gonna meet my deadline. Oh fuck, and I don't have therapy for 3 more days. Oh my god.
Yeah.
I love my friends. Well, I know you miss home, and I know you miss New York too, because you were in New York.
Yeah, first. New York is amazing.
And we don't know how long we'll have you, but I'm just so glad that you're here.
Thank you.
And I'm so glad that we finally got together. It's so crazy that we haven't podcasted up until this point. So before you go, mm-hmm. I want to close my episode with you the same way I close all my episodes. And that's asking you for your answers to my 2 big questions.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So the first, and actually so nice. One of my listeners emailed me recently. It's still in my to-do inbox. I'm so sorry. I will get back to you. I haven't even clicked through. So I can't say thank you by name, but I will soon. He compiled the last 2 questions from like all of my episodes. And I don't know if they're transcribed or what he did, but like, I think I finally have some sort of really amazing list of answers. One day I'll do a best of, I'll edit them together. It sounds like a lot of work, but one day I'll do it. I promise. So I'm really interested to hear your responses. So the first question is sort of the bummer one. We get it out of the way. And that's, when you look to the future, in whatever context matters to you, whether it's personal, global, whatever, what is the thing that you are most concerned about, most worried about, most keeps you up at night? And then on the flip side of that, to land on a lighter note, what are you most optimistic and excited about?
What concerns me about the future is water, just water. Like, I don't think I'll go into it that much, but, you know, I would say availability.
Yeah.
The thing that I am most optimistic about is how we can continue to use technology to solve problems.
And, like, water crisis problems.
Yeah.
Like we do. We see desalination
Yes.
all the time.
Yeah.
That's exciting, especially because it's one of those fucking things where it's like, it's such a limited resource, but we have so much of a version of it that makes us very sick.
Yes.
So if we could just figure out how to tap into this ocean of water and utilize it, but fresh water, it's not only do we not have enough of it, but what we have, we're poisoning.
Yes.
And I'm sitting here like just drinking this delicious Brita filtered
water. We have huge glasses of water here, but I think often like groundwater in like rural places in India where they like don't have access to the ocean and things, and they're using that to irrigate crops, except it's running out. Like, what are people going to do? And we're talking like 500,000 people. Like,
and we're talking already where the sanitation is not up to stuff. And where it's easy for us to say here, where we already have decent infrastructure. Although we've seen, as in Flint, Michigan, and a lot of other places, like our infrastructure is crumbling.
Yeah.
And we're getting lead poisoning in the water. But even still, we can talk about doing toilet to tap. We can talk about saying, oh, well, we have really good treatment plants. We can actually take brown water, not just gray water, but brown water, and clean it, which is such a fucking disgusting term.
Yeah.
And clean it to the point where we can put it in bottles and sell it to rich people.
Yeah.
Like, we're so lucky. And then you have places where just the basic level of sanitation is missing.
Yeah.
And there's still, I mean, even places that you think of as being like hoi hoi. Like, have you been to Venice? Like, not this Venice, but Venice.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Up until very recently, just the canals were a latrine.
Yes.
And they still smell like shit.
Yeah, it's a stinky city.
It's a pretty gross city.
Paris also smells bad.
Yeah, because it's just not up to snuff in terms of some of these waste facilities. And until you have the proper waste facilities, it's very hard to start talking about kind of closing the circuit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Of cycling water because it does cycle.
Yeah.
We're drinking dinosaur piss.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, we really are, that condensed in clouds and fell back down.
Yeah.
We can solve this problem.
So when I lived in the Northern Territory in Australia, mm-hmm. all of our water in the little town that I lived in was recycled.
That's amazing.
So we were a town of like only 2,000 people, but there were like four big hotels there as well. So it could have a varying population of like, I would say probably like 3,000 to 4,000 like max. Mm-hmm. And it was just so good resource-wise because you were in the middle of the country, in the middle of the desert. Like the waste disposal and the water recycling plant were like really efficient. And I think it's tough because that is a small population over a very large space. Like you could have like a tip there for like all of your rubbish, you know, like space wasn't an issue, except it was inside a national park. So that did have some kind of
like legal parameters.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just think that they did a really good job of just being a sustainable town of like 3,000 people.
Well, and the truth is you have to have these small case studies in order to be able to start scaling.
Yes.
And if we can do it at a small level, we know we can do it at a big level. You just have to make efficient changes to make it worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And so it's good to see. That's the frustrating thing. I feel like so often we try to reinvent the wheel when instead we should be like, again, let's put our hubris in check. Let's turn to our neighbors and learn from them.
Yeah.
There are people who are already solving these huge problems. And if we can build on their solutions, we're not starting from scratch.
Yeah.
And I feel good about the future, especially when it comes to resources. I mean, as much as it really does scare me, climate change really scares me. Mm. The water crisis is a huge crisis. I know the power of like human ingenuity when our backs are against the wall. I just mm-hmm. always fear that we're not forward thinking enough.
Yes.
We always do things like when it's a little too late.
Yeah. The future makes me feel nervous in a way. And I think I don't want to get all like conspiracy theorist on you, except I think that money drives our society more than what is good for it. Like,
of course it does.
Yeah. So I just think that we're going to get to a point where certain ways of living like don't make sense financially anymore, and we're just like going to panic. Yeah. I mean, I think like even the oil industry is a good example. Like we both have electric cars, and I only got mine like 6 months ago, and I love it, but it is more expensive than a normal petrol car. So I just think it's interesting because we're going to keep supporting like petrol gas car industry here until it gets to the point where like we reach peak oil, or where like the government is going to put enough incentives that people will buy electric cars. Like, I don't know, it's kind of it's weird because it would just be great if like so many people had electric cars. It would be better for the environment. It would be better for the industry. We would be able to develop batteries with more range like quicker and sooner because there's more investment in it.
But we don't. We look at it backward. Like when oil is cheap, that's a very bad thing.
Like,
it's a very bad thing when the oil price drops and we don't see it that way. Like individual consumers think, oh, great.
Yeah.
This is good for me. It's no. Oil should be so expensive that we can't afford it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm a huge, huge proponent of taxing the fuck out of oil. But but it is also hard for the little guy. It's one of those things where just like change is painful.
Yeah.
And we have to get creative about how to work more through transitional periods. Mm-hmm. I think that what we're not good at is weighing the difference between seismic change and incremental change and understanding that like we must always be incrementally working towards progress.
Mm-hmm.
But instead we want the seismic change because we want things to happen immediately.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's hard to see this other way, especially when we're dealing with, as we talked about earlier, 4-year election cycles, and we don't have a lot of incentive to affect change that'll happen in 20 years, 30 years. Like we should really take a lesson from fucking NASA.
Yeah.
Because they're so good at saying, we're going to send this thing to this place in 2037.
Yes.
And we're going to start working on it now. And we're like, wow, that's really far away. I'm just going to check out until that happens. And they go, whoa, look at all the cool shit NASA did. And they're like, yeah, we've fucking been working on it for decades.
Yeah. I often wonder what that must be like for the people that work there. I was talking to a guy in an event earlier this week who was like, I worked on, I think it was the Grace mission. I worked on that for like 15 years and it's launching in 2022. And I'm like, whoa, like I make something and publish it to the world like 2 weeks later. Like you're working on like a 30-year time span, like from the time that you start working on the project to the time that it actually will like get to wherever it's going and like deliver results and things. It just blows my mind.
And then what happens if the A, the program gets scrapped.
Yes.
Or B, there is a tragedy, which is not, I mean, it's luckily it's uncommon, but it's not so uncommon.
Yeah,
you put your life into something and then it's all for naught. Like, I can't imagine.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, there's a lot of strength and fortitude in the people that work in the space agencies.
Definitely.
They impress me so much.
Yes.
Well, Vanessa, this was so much fun.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me. I know that there's more to talk about. You are definitely one of my friends who I want to have back. So I'll be bugging you again soon, hopefully.
Sure. Part two. I mean, we could talk about science next time.
I know. Right? Well, in the meantime, see, this is good because in the meantime, go watch Braincraft. Mm-hmm. Tell everybody where they can see it.
Just youtube.com/Braincraft.
Yep. Go there, watch Braincraft, hit up Vanessa on social media. Where?
On Twitter, Instagram, even Snapchat, just at Nessie Hill, N-E-S-S-Y Hill.
Oh, Nessie.
Nessie.
I love it. And guys, thank you so much for coming back week after week. I always have so much fun, and I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.